This is Mark Steiner, and that's Ahmad Jamal. Today is his birthday, born in 1935, one of the great jazz pianists of all time. He was an amazing human being, one of the first people to take on a new name as an African-American, Ahmad Jamal. And I would say he's also the man who, when I was young, along with MJQ, turned me on to jazz as a 14-year-old, listening to his stuff. So happy birthday, Ahmad Jamal. We're about to switch gears here from our conversation about voting rights. Well, in some ways switch, in some ways they're all connected. We're going to talk about President Barack Obama's trip to Africa. He just left Tanzania this morning, where he met with George W. Bush, commemorating the bombings that took place, the people who died in those bombings, in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. But this trip was more than about the symbolism of a memorial service. People say it's a lot deeper than what we see in the news. There were demonstrations against Barack Obama receiving an award in Johannesburg. Those were not really covered in the news very much. We know that in the midst of Africa right now, there's an ongoing battle between the two great, well, capitalist powers of the planet, the United States of America and China, battling over who's going to control the resources of the continent. It's very complex, and we're going to talk with two people there who can kind of walk us through all that. Amira Woods is with us once again. It's been a while, but I'm glad she's back. Co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and a leading expert on U.S. foreign policy with the emphasis on Africa and the developing world. Miro, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's a joy to be with you and your listeners, Mark.
Abiyomi Azikwe is with us, editor of Pan-African Newswire, joins us once again. And Abiyomi, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you again for having me on.
How are you?
Fine.
Good, good, good. Good to have you both. So, Amira, let me begin with you. When the press covered this journey to Africa, I don't think it was covered that deeply, this trip to the continent, A. B, one of the factors that they reported a lot was that President Barack Obama did not go to Kenya. But this is kind of skimming the surface, Amira. I'd like to see where you would start the analysis.
Well, I start the analysis by indicating, you know, there has been this exuberance when Obama ran for office and then when he won, that a son of Africa, you know, his father coming from Kenya, would be in the highest office at the White House. And, you know, so a sense of excitement has really waned over the last few years when people move beyond the symbolism and look at the reality of U.S. policies globally, but in particular U.S. policies as it relates to Africa. So what we have seen is really more of the same. You know, I think it's quite appropriate that we saw President Obama and former President Bush today, you know, the photo op. But, you know, quite frankly, there's been a continuation of policies from Bush to Obama at the detriment of particularly Africans who were hopeful for a reset in U.S. engagement with the continent, reset of U.S. both economic policy as well as U.S. military policy as it connects to Africa, and really have seen a continuation very much in line with what was in place under the Bush administration. So, you know, when you think about, you know, the overarching emphasis of this trip being trade and investment, well, U.S. trade and investment has gone on with Africa since the days of the transatlantic slave trade. And in many respects, it's been as unequal since then. You know, it's extracting key resources vital for the global economy. Oil, gas, and mining makes up 90% of U.S. trade with Africa. And it has been really, you know, a one-sided trade where multinational corporations and the local elites that do their bidding, you know, the 1%, right, in the language of Occupy, they have taken advantage to the greatest degree of the majority of the people. The 99% are still struggling in spite of Africa's increasing, you know, rates of economic growth. 6 of the top 10 economies growing in the world are in Africa. Yet the benefits are not being spread equally. So you have entrenched inequality that will not be addressed if there is continuation of the status quo, whether it's under Bush or Obama or whomever is to come next.
Abiyomi, what does this journey say to you? What was your analysis of this journey?
Well, I agree with Sister Woods. When Obama visited Ghana in 2009, just for a few hours, he seemed to be blaming the problems of underdevelopment in Africa on African people themselves when he addressed the Ghanaian parliament in 2009. I think a lot of people took offense to that speech. He hasn't been back to the continent in 4 years. And over that period of time, we've seen the People's Republic of China. We've seen Iran. We've seen South America and most recently Japan engage Africa in dialogue around economic development. So I think the U.S., with its focus on militarism and geopolitical strategic influence, has in fact been left behind in many ways in regard to its foreign policy in relationship to the African continent. In Senegal, for example, the first country that he arrived in, there was a dispute over his comments about a Supreme Court decision that was made last week in regard to same-sex marriage. And it appears as if he got into a debate with President Macky Sall. And this did not endear him to the newspapers in Senegal or to a lot of people in Senegal. Then, of course, in South Africa, he was met by substantial protest at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria, as well as in Cape Town, and also when he was given this honorary doctorate degree at the University of Johannesburg. So I think in South Africa was probably the most pronounced criticism, taking on U.S. foreign policy in relationship to Cuba, in relationship to militarism in Africa. There were signs that condemned Obama in regard to further militarization of Africa. And, of course, in Tanzania, his last leg of his trip, he focused largely on the so-called war on terrorism, which, of course, is the raison d'etre that they have utilized for the escalation of AFRICOM's presence on the African continent. He announced back in December that he was sending 3,500 special forces and military trainers to nearly three dozen countries on the African continent. So I think he has a very difficult task in regard to trying to develop some type of Africa policy when, in fact, it doesn't appear to be a priority in terms of economic development, but is clearly a priority as it relates to militarism. And the militarism, of course, is related to the ongoing legacy of imperialist intervention on the African continent.
So let me push on this a bit further. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888 and your thoughts on this country's involvement with the mother continent, with President Barack Obama's trip to different countries in the continent of Africa. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow @gmail.com. You can also talk to us on Facebook or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. But one of the things that strikes me, we mentioned China a moment ago, Amira, and you know, it seems to me we're now setting up in this world with this kind of at loggerheads. We saw a little bit over Snowden, which was minor actually in terms of what it really means. But this battle over between two of the largest economies in the world, the United States and the People's Republic of China. And a lot of it is centered in Africa. And one of the things that Abiyama was alluding to, I mean, that China is very deeply invested in Africa. So maybe in some ways it's smarter than the U.S. in the sense that it's building roads and hospitals and bridges. But all of that, I mean, is that, to me, no different than the West in terms of its exploitation of Africa. I mean, that, and what we're seeing is just more powers leaping into sub-Saharan Africa, taking out, putting very little in, maybe, other than the kind of things that have to make people happy, like roads. Amira?
Without a doubt, you know, it is more of the same. So there is a big rush to pit the U.S. against China. You know, the administration, especially to a U.S. domestic audience, is saying, oh, the U.S. is so much better in terms of human rights and environmental protection and labor rights. But when we look at the end of the day, you know, whether it's big oil or, you know, big mining companies or big agribusiness companies, it is quite similar what U.S. Investors are doing compared to European colonial investors in the past and certainly Chinese investors today. It's how to extract as many resources for the lowest cost and how to also, you know, repatriate, well, really to steal profits and return them to their respective countries. So what you have seen with China, the estimate is that, you know, the Chinese head of state has gone to 30 African countries in the last 5 years, you know, so the comparisons are being made. But clearly, you know, there are core concerns that are both relevant when it comes to Chinese investors, as they are for American investors, and that is a complete disregard for the rights of workers, particularly in oil, gas, and mining, for the environmental damage being done, particularly to communities on whose land those resources lie, for a push not only through bilateral arrangements, but also through their influence of international financial institutions to get rid of regulations, where governments can actually regulate their economies, regulate their environment, regulate their labor rights. But there is a major push now because of the dominance of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and these key actors within those institutions essentially demanding no regulation, demanding no capital controls, so that resources, funds generated can actually be taken out of African countries into offshore bank accounts, whether it's in the Cayman Islands or elsewhere. You know, so countries like Tanzania, one of the few countries that have, in spite of the pressure, pushed forward for capital controls. I mean, it's a rarity on the continent. But essentially, it says that governments have a right to regulate their markets, to regulate their labor, to regulate the environment, to ensure that the resources of their country actually benefit the citizens of that country. That is the core, and that has been what particularly the U.S., you know, directly and through international financial institutions has been pushing. So we can look at China's experience, and we can say, yes, there are roads that have been built, there are stadiums and hospitals, but fundamentally, a lot of the foreign direct investment is more of the same. And I think the urge is to recognize that, you know, we are no longer in a bipolar world. It's not just USSR and U.S. or the U.S. and China. You now have a range of geopolitical actors, and, you know, Brazil, India. You know, clearly there is this new set of players that are also very active in their engagement, not only with Africa, but with the entire world. And so I think we have to begin to assert that this is no longer a bipolar world, but we are in this 21st century in a multipolar environment where key actors, including some on the African continent, like South Africa, will continue to play a role in determining economic policies for themselves, for their continent, their region, and really for the entire world.
And I think on that point, what you just said, Amira, it's kind of important to look at this. I mean, I think that Tanzania does stand out in some ways as almost an anomaly to the leadership of other countries on the continent of Africa, most countries on the continent of Africa, because we always have to think look at Africa as this monolith, which it clearly is not, it never has been, other than in its struggle against colonialism, which made it appear a monolith, I think, and that you look at countries, whether it's Ghana or whether it's Nigeria or South Africa or Kenya, many countries where the economic growth is moving. That the leaderships of those countries, Abiyomi, are the wealthy folks in those countries, some of whom led the struggle for independence, are doing the bidding of the Monetary Fund, the World Bank, that or the Chinese, whoever it may be. I mean, it's almost like post-colonialism, colonialism, for want of a better term at the moment.
Well, yes. I think Kwame Nkrumah, back during the 1960s, labeled the principal impediment to African development as neocolonialism. But I do disagree in regard to the role of China in Africa, because what we've seen over the last 13 years at least, and even before that, because we have to recognize that China has had relations with Africa going back to the 1950s and 1960s. They were very instrumental in regard to building the Tanzanian-Zambian railway. This was even under Mao Zedong during the Cultural Revolution. So it's nothing new that China now is developing relations with the African continent. And since 2000, there has been the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation that has held five summits, both in China as well as on the African continent. And the general opinion in Africa among governments as well as public policy experts is that the nature and character of the relations between the African Union member states and the People's Republic of China is more of an advantage as opposed to a disadvantage if you look at what has happened vis-a-vis the European Union as well as the United States and Canada. And I think this is a reflection of the fact that now Africa is the largest trading partner with the African Union member states. And, of course, for example, the Export-Import Bank of China has about 500 projects that it's financing now in Africa, and they're specifically designed to support local infrastructural projects related to construction, water treatment plants, the building of schools, irrigation systems. So I think Africa is making a choice in regard, and they have that right to make a choice in regard to who they trade with, who they set up these economic partnerships with. And I think it's hypocritical on the part of the U.S. State Department, particularly under Hillary Clinton, to say that China represented a new form of colonialism, when in fact it's the U.S. That has been involved in slavery and support of colonialism for centuries on the African continent, and are still engaged in relations with Africa that do not benefit at all the people of the African continent. But I think the governments on the continent have a right to establish these relationships. And the people, of course, have a right to ensure that these relationships benefit them as opposed to certain elite groups within these various nation states.
Amira, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think it's hard to paint too dark a picture. I think there are nuances here. Clearly, you know, it's different when China goes in and builds infrastructure. You can look back over the decades and see the roads, see the stadiums, see the hospitals. People see concrete advances when there's a notion that China is involved. And I think that is phenomenal, particularly when the U.S. Over the past 10 decades has focused so overwhelmingly on the security sector, professionalizing training in armies, you know, often to the detriment of democracy in the continent. So the U.S. has chosen one path where you see very little infrastructure development. The Chinese deliberately chose a different path. And I think that has to be acknowledged and applauded. But I think if we dig deep, we have to also acknowledge the very real labor rights violations in particularly some of the mining areas where South Africa, Chinese mining companies have been very active and very exploitative of African labor. And so you have very severe statements coming out of trade unionists on the continent with respect to some of the Chinese foreign direct investors. I think you also have environmentalists that are calling attention to the environmental impact. So I see that as, you know, kind of more of the same, a similar pattern of foreign direct investment as was followed under the colonial period and post-colonial, you know, by the Europeans, by the Americans, by the Chinese. And that, I think, has been focused on a massive extraction of resources at the expense of labor rights, at the expense of environmental protection. And this, I think, is a fundamental problem to how the foreign direct investment has played out on the continent. So we can applaud the infrastructure development without a doubt, but I think we also have to stand firm and critique, particularly the environmental and labor rights violations that are not only causing harm now, but will harm future generations and overall the survival and health of the planet.
So I'm curious what the future may hold. I mean, you know, when I was thinking as you were speaking, Amir, I was thinking about the kind of stands of some countries in South America have taken, like Brazil and Ecuador and Bolivia. These are countries who have been nominally or independent from Spanish and Portuguese rule for well over 100 years before anybody in the continent, other than a couple of countries like Ethiopia and Liberia, were independent of colonial rule. And so, I was thinking about this in terms of Nelson Mandela, and when South Africa finally toppled apartheid, that South Africa was almost emblematic to me of the rest of the continent, because what they're faced with was there was no longer a Soviet Union or Eastern Bloc that they could counterbalance the West with as they wanted to redevelop their country. So in many ways, many governments in Africa are stuck, and then the people who run those governments, as in South Africa, become almost as exploitative as the folks who came before them. I wonder what you both think, starting with Amira very quickly and Abiyami, what you think the future might hold. Where do you think, what will be the dynamic at play here?
I see the future on the streets of Egypt today. It is
millions
people.
Of people.
It is, yes.
Unbelievable.
It is trade unionists. It is women who are standing up to say the political process is not working for us and this economic model is not meeting our needs. I think they are our future. And if you look at the demographics of Africa, the majority of people are young. You know, it's like one in four are between the ages of 10 and 24. It is phenomenal. The growth opportunities in this continent for technology, for innovation, for people power. And, you know, that I believe that has how, you know, history has been transformed. It has been people, whether it's the civil rights era or the anti-apartheid struggle that you talk about and we you know, recognize with Mandela, you know, or the struggle against colonialism. It's people taking to the streets, demanding a different way. And they're doing it, not only in Tunisia and Egypt, but really in 22 countries throughout Africa. Over the last 2 years, you have seen uprisings, you have seen occupations, and I believe that that's where the hope lies.
And so, Abiyomi, how about you? I mean, how different is your take on it?
Well, I think that the U.S. emphasis on militarism and mineral extraction has not stabilized the situation in these various African states. We look at Somalia, for example. The U.S. has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in Somalia over the last few years through the African Union mission to Somalia, AMISOM. And there's still not a stabilized situation inside the country. The Central Intelligence Agency has a station in Mogadishu. They have a drone operation that extends throughout the Horn of Africa all the way over into the Seychelles in the Indian Ocean. Look at Egypt today. Since the late 1970s, Egypt has been a close ally of the United States, the second largest recipient of U.S. Direct foreign aid. And the Egyptian people today are poorer than they have been over the last several decades, and that's why there are millions of people in the streets. So I think that these various African states, in order to develop, have to break with the U.S., they have to break with the European Union, and develop links with other countries in the global south. We see that happening through the BRICS summit, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, through the Africa, South American summit. And these mechanisms, even though they're not completely effective and they're still in their early stages, I think they actually prefigure the future in regard to how the former colonial states are going to move in regard to economic development, and that they have a right to form these alliances. And I think that they are definitely a threat to U.S. and European hegemony on the continent as well.
We'll see as we have our further conversations whether any of this really helps many of the countries on the continent. But Amira, one of the things we didn't get to, we'll come to another day, but very quickly, is the change in agriculture, how many Western European and American countries are literally taking over the land.
Right, what many of us call the land grabs. You know,
right.
the country where I'm from, Liberia, you know, in the last few years, 2 million acres of land have been appropriated, mainly by large agribusiness to grow biofuels, right? To grow food to fuel cars as opposed to, you know, feeding people. So I think there's a fundamental need to examine particularly land and because I think you have massive occurrences throughout the continent where people are being tossed off their ancestral lands, being forced into more urban areas to create a cheap supply of labor. I hope we do have time to talk about that on another show.
No, we will. I mean, we're going to make that a focus. I want to come back and have you back on to do that. Amira Woods has been with us. She's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and an expert on U.S. policy with an emphasis on Africa and the developing world. Abayomi Azikwe is editor of the Pan-African News Wire. We want to thank both of you for being with us. We're actually going to move into our production of Sound Bites talking about the future of food and farming in our world coming up next, and go out with Swahili Land, one of my favorite old pieces by Ahmad Jamal, also taking us back home from 1974. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All the best, man.
You too. And we'll be right back.